Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide? No escape from reality. Open your eyes. Look up to the skies and see.
Hit the music. It's Saturday. It's just after 11, and you know what that means? It's time for the Live Science Radio Show.
Wow, what a totally amazing, excellent discovery.
It will test your head and your mind and your brain, too.
Come on, let's go, space trucker!
Ah, with an introduction like that, it can only mean one thing. Our guest speaker this week is going to be Phil Moffat from the Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society. But even though it's the fifth Saturday of the month, he's not doing his astro clinic. He's doing his general astronomical update. And he forgot he could have been on holiday, but he's not yet.
Come on.
Amazing. Anyway, you all, of course, listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live. 93.2 FM, you've got Julian Paul here live. We'll be speaking to our PG later in the show, and on the subject of Phil Moffat and the Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society, don't forget that one of their public outreach events is on tomorrow at RSPB Old Moor. It's one of their Solar Sundays. It's a free event, but if you want access to the rest of the RSPB site, I think you still have to pay. But nevertheless, it's a great opportunity to view the sun safely and hear from the experts about how the sun not only warms our planet, but also supports all life on Earth. You may even see evidence of solar flares, which are huge magnetic bursts of energy shooting into space. So that's tomorrow, Sunday the 30th of June, from 11 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. All being well, the weather's going to be slightly better than today, but if you missed that one, there's another event on Sunday the 11th of August. All good stuff.
Right, a bit of a nostalgia.
Yeah, yes. The Sunday Times magazine, sometimes they have a flashback and they put up a copy of whatever was in the colour supplement magazine at that particular time, and this one caught our eye.
This was 17th of June 1962. So that's 40, 50, 60. Ooh.
62 years ago.
So the headline was Preview of Colour TV, How It Works, What It Costs, When It Can Come. Because it hadn't come then, had it?
It hadn't.
So this week in 1962, the front cover of the Sunday Times magazine on June 17, 1962, previews the arrival of colour television, which we all take for granted now, don't we?
We do.
But the BBC tested colour with the transmission of a ballet, but the British public would have to wait until July 1, 1967 for the full launch of the service, with coverage from Wimbledon on BBC Two, presented by David Vine. At the time, listen to this, at the time, a colour TV set would have cost at least £250, almost £4,000 today.
Yeah, and somebody sent us the other day that actually some TVs do cost £4,000. But what's interesting as well, on the bottom of that colour supplement, it said something like, also in this issue.
Yeah, Laura Lee on Ibiza and Cecil Beaton on Edwardiana.
Amazing, 1962.
Wow.
Fantastic. Anyway, next up, this caught my eye, brilliant. There's a book out and it's called Love Triangle. And you might think, well, what's that got to do with science? Well, actually, it's about the life-changing magic of trigonometry. And it's written by a guy called Matt Parker. So he says it's called...
This is great, this.
The article is titled Triangles, Here's the Point. And he says, want to cut a sandwich properly or measure the distance to the horizon? It can all be done with this one magical shape.
Julie, the sandwich cutting, our friend Steve will love this, won't he?
Will they? Well, yeah. We'll see. So years ago, the mathematician Matt Parker was walking along the beach with his girlfriend when she wondered how far away the horizon was. While most people would guess, he began sketching a diagram of the problem in the sand. Using just the diameter of the Earth and the height of his girlfriend, he was able to use Pythagoras' theorem to guess that the horizon was about 5 kilometres away. His beach trigonometry, which he checked when he got home, was out by only 300 metres. And this is a startling fact. If you're 1.7 metres tall and standing on the shore of any beach in the world, the horizon will always be 4.7 kilometres away. And if you think that's... amazing, then wait till you hear this next one.
I'm going to have to go to England Mills and try that out.
So the next one he mentions in this article, did you know that the wake of a duck is always 39 degrees? So that's when they're swimming along and it leaves a little wake in the water. It's always 39 degrees. Also, he says that the shape of the structure of a beehive, which is a rhombic dodecahedron, is one of the most mathematically efficient shapes for packing. And it goes on and on about all sorts. But it's saying this book is not for everyone because algebra, computer code and A-level trigonometry equations are throughout the book. Man. But it says those who persevere with the book will end up smarter than they were when they started it. You'll be able to use triangles to understand Einstein's theory of relativity, and wow, end up at the stark realization that at the quantum level, matter, which is you, me, the magazine we're reading, the book we're reading, is all just a set of triangles.
Ooh. Do the sandwiches.
Oh, what about the sandwiches?
How you cut them up?
Well, where does it say that then?
How do you cut sandwiches up properly?
Well, I don't, into triangles, I suppose.
It's okay.
Do you think it's in this article? I'm not sure it is. Or it might be. You're going to have to give me some more time to find it.
Don't worry. Anyway, all right, okay. Moving on.
The most effective way to cut sandwiches is it involves 3 triangles and 12 sub-triangles. Get that. Who knew?
What shape of your bread dough to do? That square, I suppose.
Next up, this week's environment update. We've got all sorts coming up.
Sowing seeds. A Scottish rewilding initiative has smashed its targets for collecting rare native tree seeds in a boost for the country's ancient woodland. The 3-year tree seed collection project aimed to collect enough seeds in its first year to plant 500,000 trees, but its team of volunteers gathered enough for 1.5 million.
All good stuff. Woo. Next one, excellent eagles. Sticking with Scotland, golden eagle numbers have continued to rise thanks to continued conservation efforts. The South of Scotland Golden Eagle Project began in 2018 when just 3 breeding pairs remained in the area, but annual release releases of Chicks and the relocation of others from Northern Scotland have brought numbers up to 47, which is the highest number in centuries.
Talking of birds, round where we live, we've got three buzzards.
We have. We've seen a lot. One flew over very close.
Over our house.
I mean, there must be rich pickings where we are.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Paper Recycling Rethink, a joint report between Sunderland, Gateshead and South Tyneside Councils has found a continual decline in the amount of paper being collected for recycling. Since 2014, local authorities said paper recycling had fallen from between 15 to 22% to around 3 to 6%. Waste management groups in each area said they were considering different ways to collect paper for recycling, as the current curbside collection system was not sustainable. The reduction in paper recycling has been linked to the decline in printed media, ranging from newspapers to telephone directories and junk mail.
The world is changing, eh?
Yes.
Indeed. Cumbria Battery Storage Facility. A company called Net Zero 17 Limited wants to create a battery storage facility on agricultural land in Asbatria in Cumbria. The aim of the project is to support the move towards a low carbon energy network, as it would help release electricity at periods of high demand and store it at times when it's not needed. If approved, it needs planning permission, the battery storage facility could store enough electricity to power about 162,000 homes for 2 hours.
Swift City. Residents, community groups and local politicians in Lancaster have signed a charter recognised by the RSPB, which sets out their commitment to protecting Swifts. They have pledged to turn their hometown into a Swift City by creating more nesting sites and by creating more wildflower areas to attract more insects for them to feed upon. Swift numbers in the UK have fallen by 60% in the last 25 years due to habitat loss.
Yeah, sad news, eh? So Wales recycling. Wales has been named as the second best country in the world for recycling. So in Wales, they recycle 58.6% of all its municipal waste, which was pipped to the post by Austria, which recycles 59%. Wales sets statutory recycling targets for local councils and provides homes with multiple containers to separate their waste. Northern Ireland made the top 10 in 9th place. England just missed out at 11th place and Scotland was placed 15th.
Right, saving the shrike. Efforts are underway to restore British populations of the red-backed shrike, a bird that was driven to extinction in this country in the 1980s amid intensifying agricultural practices. Conservationists at the Iford Estate in East Sussex are cultivating areas of scrubland to provide suitable habitats for the birds. Other species such as nightingales and butterflies will also benefit. The project is part of a wider effort to create a 100-mile wildlife corridor from Ashdown Forest to the sea.
Oh, I think Ashdown Forest is Winnie the Pooh land, isn't it, I think? Anyway, finally, and closer to home, Yorkshire Water investing £2 million to tackle river sewage discharges in Barnsley. The project to build nearly 300 cubic metres of additional storage in the sewer network on the River Dearne near Barrow Green aims to slow the flow of wastewater during prolonged or heavy rainfall and is expected to be finished in November this year. Any storm water collected in the new storage tank will be held until the heavy rain stop so it can be treated correctly before being discharged into the River Dearne at Dearne Hall Road. There you go.
I come from down in the valley where mister when you're young they bring you up to do like your daddy done. Me and Mary we met in high school and she was just 17. We drive out of this valley down to where we go down to the river, and into the river we dive.
down the aisle. No flowers, no wedding dress. That night we went down to the river. Then into the river we dive. Oh, down to the river we did ride. Yeah, yeah.
What a shame to turn that off. What a lovely track.
Yes, Paul was loving that.
He was. The River by Bruce Springsteen, because we're talking about Yorkshire Water are investing £2 million to tackle river sewage discharges in Barnsley. A hot topic around the country, river sewage discharging without being treated. If you just tuned in, you are, of course, listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live. 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. We should have our PG on the line.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hello.
We have liftoff.
Good now, gracious.
I know you were enjoying that track, weren't you? You're a big Bruce Springsteen fan, aren't you, Paul?
It is, and also a very appropriate track for something I'm going to talk about. So.
How did we know?
You're so clever.
Well, I was expecting, well, we've talked about teeth, we've talked about eyes, I was expecting to be talking about the ears, the nose, something like that, but no.
Not to be sneezed, that's a different topic this week.
Oh, so, come
keep,
on.
I'll keep my eye out for something to follow on the others.
Brilliant.
Well done.
Okay, but this is about a study concerning the world's longest rivers, but also about rivers in general. So, two-thirds of the world's longest rivers are no longer free-running. That means that they've got dams or they've got intrusions into the flow of the river. And already still 3,700 major dams in progress across the world. So it's a joint study from a chap called Bernhard Lerner at McGill University in Canada and the World Wildlife Fund in Washington, D.C. Using satellite and aerial survey and other data, they've examined 12 million kilometres of waterways, and they managed to do that in 4.5 kilometre sections. And they studied the impact not only of dams, but other things like river levees that are a relief for excessive flow and the other flood control structures, because we hear a lot about that now with the climate shift that we've got. Their particular focus on the 246 longest rivers, which have got a total of 1,000 kilometres of waterway. For example, the Nile and the River Mississippi are some of the biggies. But only 90 of these 246 are still free-flowing. So the effects in controlling it have a real impact on freshwater plants and animals, which are declining at a rate twice as fast as those on Earth. In the sea population. So Michelle TM of World Wildlife, who's a freshwater ecologist, said that as a result of the study, World Wildlife are now advocating increased use of solar and wind power to reduce the demand for hydroelectric power. And some of the impacts of this study is in February, Slovenia halted development of a hydro system on the Mura River, as it's one of the last refuges for otters and Danube salmon. And also Mexico's established water reserves, in 300 river basins to support nature. So it's just a thing with water. I think very surprising that a long time ago there were stories coming out about the Yellow River and the Yangtze River when it was being dammed. There's also on the Nile, the Aswan Dam is a famous latter-day development of blocking off the river, controlling the flow to give hydroelectric power, but also sending it off to irrigate areas that wouldn't naturally be irrigated by the current systems. And again, talking about rivers, there's been another study which looks at the very initial flows that start a river off. That's a report in one of the magazines by Brinkerhoff and company, who are all scientists, and they've looked at how dry streams will fill up when it gets rainy, and they'll sort of contribute to flow, which eventually becomes a tributary, which eventually becomes part of these big river systems. And they're saying that basically they do change, and it kind of put me in mind of some basic geography things I did when they talked about the after effects of the glacial period, and they talked about the way river flows change there with the development of oxbow lakes. So if there's a big bend in the river, eventually the river manages to drive across the end and join the straighter bits of the river, and leaves just a horseshoe or oxbow, they call it, shaped lake behind. And it's amazing that we rely so much on water. As I said, I think it's like below a couple of percent of the world's water supplies are potable, the drinkable. So actually looking at them as a source of power now, I think it just sort of kind of puts you in mind of the butterfly effect. You think you're doing a great thing because you've got this great natural resource, and in something like the Nile, it's flowing through umpteen different countries. So if one decides to put a big dam in, it can have a massive impact downstream on other people. And interesting to see that we're managing to use satellites again and aerial sort of observations to try and get a bit better understanding of the river systems that we rely on.
Yeah, it's important stuff, isn't it, Paul?
Yeah, I think it is. And while I was out walking back from a bit of shopping yesterday, I came down the side of the road and the little grass verge, and I thought, oh, that's a scruffy-looking patch in the grass verge. And what's happened there? And stuck in the middle of this patch was a little placard which said, "This is part of the Sheffield Pollinators Project."
Oh.
I thought, oh, that's so I looked, and I thought, oh, this looks like it's two, like a turf strip, two strips of planting side by side, about a square metre's worth, using the grass verge. And what's happened is the University of Sheffield, Sheffield Council, and the sort of people who look after the roads and highways have got together with this scheme to introduce wildflower pollinators in and around the city. And I thought, oh, that's brilliant. What a great thing, great start. I know I left my grass to grow well into the, well past the sort of start of the season. I'd normally give it a cut just because we luckily now get quite a lot of bees and other insects. And I think one of the things that sort of crops up in looking at that is that although honeybees get the big gold star tick for being pollinators, there are over 1,500 other insects that are pollinators. So it's great to bring them together. And just as a sort of knock-on from that, happened to see a little piece about the Botanical Gardens. Friends of the Botanical Gardens in Sheffield, on July the 8th at 6 o'clock, I think it's a Monday, Friends of the Botanical Gardens have organised a public guided tour which is based on the pollinators Yeah, you can have a wander around. If you want to find out the exact details, go to FOBS, Friends of British Air, sheffield.co.uk. It's starting off outside the Dorothy Fox Education Centre, and although it's free, they suggest that a £3 donation would be an appropriate gift for that. But it's a series of walks and things. So if you're into nature, if you're into flowers, if you're a gardener, then Friends of Botanical Gardens organise these sort of tours, guided tours, information. Nice walk around a lovely place, Botanical Gardens.
Yeah, it is.
And I'll say, it just sort of seemed to be the things that happened coincidentally in and around me this past week. Also, I think a bit of news on the University of Sheffield, which is great because it's a project to show off inspirational women. It's a project called Our People within the university. And from 300 nominees, they've come out with portraits of 21 women to show what their contribution is to the university. It's open for members of the university from the 25th of June, but I would heartily suggest to them that it sounds like it might be an appropriate thing to make public. Just to give some credit to women in science and a lot of the areas that the university works in. So.
Yeah, we were only thinking this morning how much quieter it is in the city centre. And I think it's because the universities have finished for the summer.
Yeah, well, probably, because on Friday there were hundreds of staff and students from the university did a sponsored walk for MND to raise funds for MND research, which, again, is an MND research centre in the university that's doing great things, so that's pretty good.
And so then that's motor neuron disease for people. MND,
yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
It's the problem that Rob Burrows, the rugby player, had, and sadly we lost him a couple of weeks back.
Yeah.
Then.
And Stephen Hawking, same thing.
And continuing people. I know one of the sufferers is doing the sort of high peaks climbs of the UK peaks at the moment to raise money. So interesting. And the only other bit of the news was from one of the professors at the university who does MND research is saying that there's a new drug which can help, I think, about 2% of people, that NICE, the panel that choose what drugs are available to people, have turned down. I think it's called Telfos or Telfos. That, again, is related to MND. But, again, the University of Sheffield is involved in research in that sort of area. Artificial intelligence, we've talked a lot about. Well, some people are fighting back. Combination of Sony Music, Universal Music, and Warner Records have got together to sue Suno and Udio, which are the AI companies. I think the first of those is linked to Microsoft. They're suing for copyright infringement.
Oh, interesting, Paul.
Well, we saw this, and I did report about it, with the New York Times suing because of using their material, their content, to train these systems. And again, that's the argument in this, is that they're using the music without paying copyright to train their artificial intelligence systems. So that's ongoing.
Uh-huh.
I think the artificial intelligence companies are saying it's rubbish. And, yeah, we'll see. But it's an ongoing case, I think it's backed by the Recording Industry Association of America. So I think, you know, the intellectual property owners are fighting back a bit, I think.
Well, if Sony, Universal and Warner have gone in together, they're pretty serious about it then, aren't they?
I think, you know, it's like New York Times, you know, I mean, that's the major sort of organ of news in America, and it too felt it's got a way into this thing, because the way the artificial intelligence systems develop is to consume loads and loads of material, so they just churn loads of songs through it, and it does the computery bit of compare, contrast, analyse, to come up with the things it puts forward.
Mm. But are the companies wanting them to stop doing it, or are they just wanting to be paid?
Well, I think there's a bit of both, as usual. I think they'd be happy for them to use the music if they paid appropriate fees. So I think there's a big chunk of money is what they'd like to see before AR develops and becomes a huge genre and tells them to go away, I guess.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because you could have... If they're doing that based on music, there's loads of other things that you could say a similar thing.
Well, I say newspapers, you know,
yes.
Journalism,
photographs, the art.
Yeah, all of sort of human endeavours can contribute to the process for AI. So that's it. But talking about music, we've had Swiftyism in the last week or so. And Taylor Swift's concerts maybe makes the earth move for you, but surprisingly, on the Wembley shows over 3 days, seismologists set up monitors around to find out what shook the earth.
Interesting.
So they found
out her rendition of her track Love Story created a 0.8 magnitude equivalent of an earthquake.
Good grief. Oh, my
God. Not really massive, but also they said that the arrival of her boyfriend, Travis Kelce's arrival registered on the seismograph. And the concerts she'd just finished in Edinburgh were picked up by seismic monitoring stations that were over 6 kilometres away from the venue.
That's an interesting one. So,
Paul.
Yeah.
Is this the new clapometer then?
Yeah, I think so, yeah, probably. They're interesting. They're saying, surprisingly, some of the noise patterns they picked up were probably due to the different way that people dance to different tracks. So maybe they were picking up the Prince of Wales dancing, doing his dad dancing with the kids.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, well, it's a strange thing that people do, eh?
Well, it's, as I said, the butterfly effect is amazing, isn't it? You don't think of it in those terms. So one of my favourite venues was... when he went to Bramall Lane in 82, Bruce Springsteen, and he played 2 dates, and the thing is, half of Sheffield got a free concert from quite a distance away when they were playing.
Did you say Bruce Springsteen? Do you mean Bruce Springsteen?
Bruce Springsteen, yeah, sorry.
Oh, come on, Paul.
teeth won't fit.
Get your own.
Hey, on that note, Paul, to be fair, if they'd used that seismic testing for some of the bigger concerts many years ago, the big rock concerts up in Leeds, and, you know, I bet they would have picked some right vibes up, not just from the audience, but from the actual, all the equipment that we're using.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's incredible. And it still is, you know. I think one of the things now is... controlling it. I know in Glastonbury they did a lot of work to find out how our music carried from the stages, just to, if it's in a reasonably good position away from a lot of built-up areas, but some of the local villagers certainly heard things, and because they're going all through the night.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing from Glastonbury this year was they used the drone fleets as a light show at the beginning. So a massive fleet of drones were creating the pictures in the sky.
Oh, amazing, eh? Well, at least the weather's going to sort of roll out for them. It looked all right last night anyway.
Well, yeah, it's supposedly going to be a bit changeable weekend. I noticed this cat came in and told me off because it was raining.
Oh. Brilliant. Great stuff, Paul, as always. We'll speak to you Monday. Glory's Rock Show. One, two, three. Bye-bye, Paul.
Thank you, Paul.
Bye.
See you guys.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
So tell me, what's really news after all? The king broke a string, did that warrant five captain calls. Excuse me, your news has dead and I die. We are just a dog, now who is the fastest alive? You're pretending there, but your enemy is showing its face. You drop the guitar, the ballpoint has taken its place. Your ego's suffering a blow when your idol showed its disdain. You say that you're unbiased, well, you must think that way deep. I've heard that. And use what lives by his pen. May I suggest, it's likely that he lives in one then. What happens after you lie down at night? In your case, the lie is not reclining. You can lie best upright. We're not.
And if you've just tuned in, you are, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. And no, we haven't forgot about you, Phil. We should have Phil Muffet on the line. Good morning, Phil.
Oh, good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we all got a bit confused where you were going, when you're going, but brilliant. So you're not doing your Astro Clinic this week. You're going to do What's in the Sky and all that. Now, I think I've said at the top of the show that Mexman Swinton Astronomical Society have got one of their solar Sundays tomorrow.
Yes, if I remember rightly, it's at Wentworth Garden Festival.
Oh, tomorrow. It's not at Old Moor then?
The Old Moor is next month.
Is that August? Ah, originally I picked up that it was at Old Moor. So it's actually at Wentworth, is it?
Yeah, they're having a fete on the field. So
wow.
We've got a stall there.
Amazing.
The doors open at 11 o'clock tomorrow, so if anybody wants to see us in the flesh, we'll have some telescopes on display to have a look at the stones.
So where will the stand be set up? Is it near the Camellia House where you did before or somewhere else?
Well, we've not done it for a long time, so I don't know where they've got us in the field. We'll not know until we turn up tomorrow.
Well, I hope the weather stays good.
I'm sure it should be. It should be okay for tomorrow. We'll have some telescopes so you can look at the sun in different frequencies.
So you've not done This is a festival, isn't it? The last time you did an event at Wentworth Woodhouse, it was actually linked to the Camellia House, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. This one's a Wentworth Fete.
Right, so we're going to get Paul on the laptop looking at what Wentworth are saying. I presume you have to pay to go into the garden then to be part of your event.
For the one at the Camellia House, but the one in the garden party one that they have at the in the Wentworth on the field, that's open to all the public. You'll not pay to get into that.
No, but you still have to pay to get into Wentworth Gardens itself, I think. That's what I mean. Yes, excellent. Yes, yes. So let's hope you can see, you'll be able to see all sorts and learn all sorts.
So sun should be out. There's loads of sunspots on the sun at the moment, and there was a flare a couple of days ago, and there was a big aurora yesterday, but it wasn't in our day. It wasn't at our night time. It was our daytime, but other parts of the world could see an aurora yesterday. So because it's in the summer in the Northern Hemisphere, it's difficult to see the aurora. And we've got less darkness. If that's the point I was going to make, this last month and this month, it doesn't really get dark. So if you're up at 1 o'clock in the morning, the sky's still light.
No.
My sleep pattern over the past couple of weeks is completely non-chaotic.
Really? Is that because you're trying to stay up to see things?
I've been stopping up like 12 while 1. I've been trying to get a little bit of sleep and then stopping up 12 while 1 to try and photograph this T. Corona Borealis, which is what we're going to talk about. So it's a flare star. It's a recurrent nova, and it's in the constellation Corona Borealis near the star Eta. And what happens is there's a super red giant and there's a white dwarf orbiting it in a period of about 288 days, a bit like Jupiter orbits our sun. But this star, it's a really dense star, and it's sucking off the energy that's been emitted from the red giant. So apparently what happens is the star goes up and down in brightness. For about every 80 years, it explodes. Now, it doesn't go supernova. It's a recurrent nova, which means I think what we think happens is it gets heavier and heavier and heavier, implodes, explodes, blows off the shell, and you see a huge peak in brightness for 2 days to a week, and then it goes back to its normal brightness, and then it starts sucking off the energy from the red giant again.
Oh, so it's a perpetual cycle then.
That's right, yeah. So it's feeding energy. So the white dwarf would have been a bigger star in its past, but it's had an explosion, shrunk to a white dwarf, but because it's in a close proximity to the red giant, it's sucking the material away. So it's adding extra fuel to the star. It's a bit like throwing coal on a fire. So it brightens up. But every now and again, it sheds off a layer because of the density of the star. So it blows it off.
So this is, are you saying this only happens every 80 years?
For this star, it's about every 80 years.
So is it in its peak activity then? Is that why you're trying to look at it?
Yeah. So the said it was going to re-explode this June, July. So I'm hoping, while it's really high up in the sky, it's up. So when you look at the summer constellations, we've got constellations like Orpheus, we've got Hercules, we've got Corona Borealis. They're all really high in the southern sky, so we can see them really easy. So I'm hoping it's going to go pop while it's high up in the sky. We've got to see it. Really
so you've easy. Become obsessed, Phil, basically.
Well, I've never seen a supernova before, and to actually catch one from the wicket. So at the moment, the magnitude's 10.2, which you can see. It's on the edge of a pair of binoculars. I can see it in the telescope, and I've photographed it with a camera.
Wow.
With a
phone.
So we can see this, and what I want to do is I want to capture it when it's bright as well, and then go back to it being dim. So but I've never seen a recurring supernova either. Well, a recurring nova. So it's an interesting object. It's a really interesting
So Paul's
object.
Saying, how far away is it then? I know you can see it.
I think it's about 30,000 light years.
Oh!
I think it is. Yeah. So it's just on the verge of amateur equipment. So if I've got a 4.5-inch reflector, that'll see down to magnitude 12. I've got 8-inch reflector LC down to magnitude 13 and a bit, and I've got a refractor LC down to about 11 magnitudes. So all your amateur gear can see this star before it explodes.
That's assuming you've bought all the amateur gear, the extras. So how many? I can see where this is going, Phil, with your new telescope, because we were going to do an. Well, when you're doing next, do your astro clinic. I asked you, would you mind talking about buying a new telescope and the steps you went through and what you've learned and stuff like that? Because I bet if you went, you'd put a lot more.
You can't retire now, can
you? You've got to keep spending.
Yeah, but well, it's one of those hobbies where you can do. Well, for instance, I photographed this T. Corona Borealis last week. I got a very short window. Clouds are a bit dodgy. Shall I get the telescope out? Shan't I get it out? Is it going to rain? Isn't it going to rain? I got the binoculars out on a tripod, fastened my iPhone to the back of the binoculars, and I managed to photograph this star at magnitude 10 through a pair of bird-spotting binoculars.
Wow.
So my point is, you can do astronomy relatively cheaply with £100-£200 worth of gear, but then you can also do it to a next level where you've spent a few £1,000. The thing is, it's the accuracy, the detail, and the results that get improving. In fact, I'm going to bring something else in here. We had a brilliant talk from a lady called Christine Doan from Durham University, and she's a rocket scientist.
I saw this on social media.
Black holes, absolutely brilliant talk. And she showed us the latest photograph of a black hole. Something popped up on my phone yesterday, which was an image of the first IBM computer printout of what they thought a black hole looked like from the 1970s. And the image is very, very similar to to a modern day computer image, and also the actual image taken by radio telescopes and photographic telescopes. Now, my point is, both images are very similar, but what's improved over the past 50 years, it's the level of detail and accuracy that's improved. So back in 1970s, and Einstein, when he was trying to put these ideas together, they actually worked it all out. What the key is with modern technology and equipment is, you can get it to a better level of detail.
Yeah.
So, so that's where we go. And that's where astronomy's gone. We've been able to do these kinds of things for years. But the fact is, it's getting easier and better for amateurs to do this kind of work and do studies and follow stuff and see what's happening. Whereas before, you were relying on experts and big observatories to do this kind of stuff, and then they publish it in a book or a magazine. Now you can do lots of stuff for yourself. Some of the photographs on the internet, on Facebook especially, some photographs people are taking are absolutely superb.
They're amazing, aren't they? Modern technology. But no, I saw that because Maxwell Swinton Astronomical Society, since COVID, you've done a lot of online chats, haven't you? You put a lot of stuff up on for people to share. So I saw you commented that you on that lady's presentation. She's from Durham University.
She actually operated an X-ray telescope on the space shuttle when they did some X-ray. I can't remember the name of the X-ray telescope they used, but it was actually the cargo bay of the space shuttle. She was on Earth in NASA, and she actually drew the telescope from Earth in the actual space shuttle, and they were taking some images of X-ray objects when they were looking for black holes. So it's absolutely amazing. And she now works at Durham University. So, yeah.
Out of interest, Phil, how did the club get to know about her, or did she get to know about you?
Our current guest speaker organiser contacts different universities, ask them if they've got any lecturers that would like doing this all the time. And they'll come online for an hour or two. In fact, some of them stop in the rest of the meeting and listen to what we have to say and talk to us. So we get a good hour with these people. But remember, they're in education, and they're also out there to promote education, and they're also to disseminate.
Yeah, to share the knowledge.
To share, yeah, and they'll get CPD for it and stuff.
Yes, but it's all good. It's all good stuff, isn't it? Sharing knowledge and that you know that they're going into research generally, aren't they? Trying to push the boundaries of what they can. See.
Well, one of our members brought up a good point on in the meeting, and he said, "What can the amateur do?" From home that you guys are doing. And she said, once NASA have took photographs, whether it's on the Hubble Space Telescope or the James Webb, after a year, well for the first year it's confidential, and the people that drive the interest get the information, but after a year it's archived, and anybody can access their archive at NASA, and they can download information and you use the data for their own purposes to produce.
Wow, that's quite a thing, isn't it, actually?
So the spin-off from that's absolutely huge. So there'll be lots of people all over the world. Well, it's like a bit like the Voyager stuff. There's some people using today's technology. They've downloaded the old images and reprocess the images from NASA back in the 1980s, and they've brought out more detail in the image because the technology is better, and they can process stuff that we couldn't do before. So it's not just brand new stuff; it's old stuff people can use as well.
Yeah, that's the importance of research, isn't it, and that archive that you can actually go back into. In fact, do you know, one of the times you came to talk to us, that you were talking about some of the material they brought back from, I think, from Mars or something, and they analysed, they shared whatever they brought back. It's only a tiny bit of rock or something, but they shared it across universities and research institutes across the whole of the world, so each person could have a look at it. But they also kept like 80% of it in storage for a point in hundreds of years' time. The technology might be such you can find out a lot more. Yeah,
that's right. And it's really clever stuff. The thing with the Jupiter images as well from Voyager and Pioneer, they've looked and found some spots in the surface on Jupiter and identified where they think some objects have actually hit Jupiter in the past that we didn't know about.
Really?
And this was all since the Shoemaker-Levy incident. People have gone back through the archives and said, have we had any other incidents like this that we never noticed before? And people have actually spotted a couple of some images where they think like either other comets or asteroids have flown into the into Jupiter.
Amazing.
Talking of asteroids as well, I've also been following my third asteroid, the second in size, and that's in Coma Berenices as well. In fact, it's just past T Corona Borealis. I managed to photograph T Corona Borealis and Pallas in the same image. So I've ticked off three this year, and hopefully next month I'm going to try and tick off Ceres, which is in Sagittarius, which will just be above the horizon this next month, about midnight. So I'm going to try and take that one off. Hopefully I'm going to get four asteroids this year that I've not seen before.
And then what's the next challenge? You're just waiting for it to go darker, aren't you? Admit it, Phil.
Yeah. But August, to be honest, the next big thing will be August because there's a Perseid meteor shower. So I'll try and do a little bit of radio work with that and follow the shower and photograph.
Yeah, the meteor showers, yeah.
Yep, and then I think August and then into September. They're really the sweet months, I think, for observing, because there's some really good constellations up in the sky, and it's not cold in an evening.
Yeah,
I've just had a fleece on in the back garden. The stuff's not got icy because it's not been that cold. The weather's been quite good. So it's just the problem with this time of year, everything's really late at night. And 1 o'clock is all late night for me.
You can't burn the candle at both ends, Phil, can you?
I can't.
No.
It's impacted my training as well. My HRV status has gone down on me.
Oh.
On my Garmin.
And oh,
it's like
dear.
I've been tired.
Well, you can't burn the... You can't get up early, go running, swimming, and then stay up at night after chasing, not enough time, too much.
I'm having to manage my time better.
Oh, blimey. So what else is coming up at Mechtram Swinton Astronomical Society? Who's on next as a speaker, do you know?
Fear of the Heavens by Richard Goodrick, that's next week. And then the week after, we've got a talk on Benno and Back and how the asteroids have created the world. And the week after, we've got Antikythera by Mike Edmonds. And then the week after that, we've got Newtonian physics. Neutrino physics. And then the week after that, we've got micro to macro. So we've got a massive
program.
Sometimes people, what do you talk about? Well,
there's so much.
What we actually talk about, we've got everything from history to physics to black holes and everywhere. Well, you name it, we do it.
It's everything, isn't it? Amazing.
Yes. Oh, other thing is, we've got an American member online now.
Oh.
So someone's joined our club from America, which is interesting.
Wow. Keeping eyes on you, Phil. That's what it is.
He was really impressed with our guest speaker.
Ever since you've had that, you've got your new telescope, eh?
Yes.
America's interested in you now, keeping tabs on you. Oh, brilliant stuff, Phil. Thanks so much for joining us. We're going to have to let you go, I'm afraid.
Okay, no worries.
Thanks very much. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and we'll speak soon. Bye-bye, Phil.
Cheers, guys, everybody.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Cause you're a sky, cause you're a sky. Start. I'm gonna give you my heart. Cause you're a sky, cause you're a sky full of stars. Cause you light up the path. I don't care. Get life.